Didn't need a charge.
Well, good morning, everybody. It is good to be with you. My name's Luke. If you're familiar with that movie from Christopher Nolan's movie Oppenheimer, it's about the man who invented and oversaw the tests of the first atomic bomb. And there are two scenes in the movie that stood out for me. One was just that scene there where it's been tested for the first time. I don't know about you, but what's so powerful about that scene particularly is how there's zero soundtrack when the explosion goes off. It's kind of like, from a cinematic perspective, it's the way of drawing our attention and the audience's attention to something very significant is going on in this moment. The second scene that stood out to me is the final scene, and I hope I'm not spoiling anything, but it's been out for a couple of years, so hopefully... If you want to see it, you've seen it by now. The final line of the film includes the dialogue between Einstein and Oppenheimer, where Oppenheimer says to Einstein, after he has come to the realization of how his scientific work, his supposedly successful test with no fatalities, is actually not as good as he might have once thought. He said this: "When I came to you with those calculations, we thought we might start a chain reaction that would destroy the world. I believe we did." Now, he's, of course, referring to what we now know, that when nuclear weapons were invented, and it was a turning point in world history. There is no turning back. They weren't invented so much for the good of humanity, were they? Christians actually believe that there is an event far more glorious, far more hope-filled, far more wonderful that has actually changed the course of history far more than the event that happened. As significant as that was in the invention of the nuclear bomb, the atomic bomb, and it is the event we're celebrating today, not terrified of, it's the event of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the grave. Why are you looking for the living among the dead? That's the question that those dazzling messengers, those angels ask the women early on that Sunday morning when they come to put spices on Jesus' body to preserve and honor it in burial. I don't know if you've ever received one of those. I would take it as quite an encouraging comment, but the phrasing, the grammar, is actually in the form of a rebuke. Where it's the effect of the words, though, is great comfort. So one example would be you're at a restaurant and you are taking out your wallet to pay for the meal and the other person says, "Why are you trying to pay the bill? I've already gone up and settled. It's all paid," right? It's one of those words. It's worded like a kind of a rebuke. Why are you doing that? But actually, the intent behind it is comfort, reassurance. That's the kind of question the women are faced with there on that first Sunday morning as they search for the body of Jesus, as they are given this question to help them see afresh, to see clearly reality. They're actually carrying, the way that they're actually thinking and behaving is actually comes from a mistaken view of Jesus. And when you unpack the words of this angel, these angels and the messengers, I think there are at least three ways that these women are mistaken in this scene. And the author shows us, first of all, this has got nothing to do with the fact that they are women, because the men make the exact mistake a little bit later in the passage. But these women who are first on the scene, they hear these words, "Why are you looking for the living among the dead?" The first problem that they have is that these women are actually looking for the dead among the dead, if that makes sense. That is, they don't think that Jesus is alive. That might sound obvious. They think he's dead. And where do you go to find dead bodies? You find them in tombs, in cemeteries, in places like that, graveyards. It's a perfectly normal place to go to find a dead body. Now, people still do this all the time today. When I go to funerals at crematoriums and cemeteries, it's very normal to see visitors around, walking around, standing behind gravestones, maybe of a family member, in reflection, even quiet speech. That's where you go when you want to pay respect to people who have died. And this is what the women thought that they were doing. If Jesus was dead, this is the right place to be, right? But the mistake that the women make on that first Sunday morning is a mistake that many of us actually can still make today, whether we believe that Jesus is still dead. We can still act like that. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, there are plenty of good, wonderful dead people throughout history. That is, we might show a great deal of respect and honour to some incredibly influential people throughout history, whether they're great figures of history or whether they're just very significant figures in your own life that have passed away. But at the end of the day, these are people who are of history. They are in the grave. And the honour, their legacy, we honour their legacy, possibly depending on whether they had a good influence on your life, what lessons they taught you, all those kind of things. And so I think we can do the similar thing with Jesus. In fact, we might be here today paying homage and respect to Jesus in a way that people might visit their mother's gravestone once a month, a few times a year, whatever it is, to remind yourself that they're not forgotten, that they have a significant part in your life. You want to honour them. We can do it with Jesus, can't we? Now, everyone here, I assume, today, by virtue of being here today, are probably not so repulsed by Jesus that you cannot even contemplate him. But the reality is we can still, all of us, what we believe in our head, can treat Jesus as no different to a great dead figure from history. Influential, not forgotten, but still dead. The second related problem, I think, implied by the angel's question, why are you looking for the living among the dead, is that, well, because Jesus is alive, they're actually searching in the wrong place. So imagine you had received the wonderful news that your best friend had just had their baby, and you text them and you say, "When can I come to visit?" And they say, "Come over right now, would love you to meet the little bub." And instead of driving to the maternity ward, you drive to the crematorium, and you start walking around wondering why you can't find the mama bub. Why? You're looking for the living among the dead. It's not where you go. It's ridiculous. Jesus is to be found among the living, not the dead. So if you keep looking for Jesus among the dead, you're never going to find him. Now, again, there's a version of that that we can be involved in today. As I mentioned just a moment ago, we can treat Jesus as belonging to the pages of history. We only ever engage with him as a dead guy from the past. But when it comes to our present and our future, Jesus has nothing to do with it, because Jesus is an historical figure, not part of my present and not part of my future in any meaningful way. Sure, he might influence me about, you know, his character might shape my character, but in a meaningful way, not really. But there are other versions, I think, the mistake the women can make that can be made for us as well. We can look for the living among the dead, a little bit like the Indiana Jones thing that we were just doing a few moments. We can look for the treasures of this world and treat them like that is where you find the meaning of life. That is where you find purpose. That is where you find significance. That's where you find value. That's the stuff that's really going to last. Now, whether we find ourselves obsessing on our, you know, whether it's our mortgage, our family, our passions, our hobbies, whatever it is, we can find ourselves acting as if the things that are living, the things that actually give life, are in the transitory things. And they're often very good things, aren't they? It could be, you know, obsessing over finding the perfect job that your heart has been set on that ticks all the right boxes. You can find yourself obsessed with trying to find life in temporary things. Now, we might never admit this is what we're doing, but maybe the people who know you best might be able to see you're living with a confidence and a passion in things that are not going to last. The third mistake that the women make, which is not so much implied by the angel's question, but really a little bit revealed in what follows, is the women have forgotten that Jesus' words explain the reality of the world. Jesus' words explain the reality of the world that they're living in. They've forgotten that Jesus' words explain reality. See there in verse 6, the angels say, "He's not here, he's been resurrected. Remember how he spoke to you when he was still in Galilee, saying, 'The Son of Man must be betrayed into the hands of sinful men, be crucified and rise on the third day.' And then they remembered his words." Now, there are a few things to note about the angel's words here. First of all, we see that Jesus' death and resurrection are not just events of history, and not even just unusual events of history. They're not just simply some incredible event that people believed happened, but they can't really make head to tail of why it happened. Jesus already spoken about and anticipated that these events will happen. It's interesting as well, it goes further than that. Jesus isn't just saying these events will happen, a bit like sometimes the Old Testament prophets might do that. This is going to happen, then this is going to happen. Jesus says, they will happen, they must happen. Now, what does that mean? What that means is that these events are not just not an accident. When Jesus talks about what must happen, he's talking about his mission, his purpose, why he came, and what he has come to do are all bound up in these events. In fact, the reality of Jesus' resurrection is central to understanding the reality of who Jesus is. Without the resurrection, the Jesus you respect and admire is actually very different to the Jesus of history and the Bible. Without the resurrection, the Jesus that you believe in is actually a Jesus of fiction. Even though many will claim the resurrection is the events of fiction. When the angel says, "Why are you looking for the living in the place of the dead?" Well, there's a very literal context for those words, which we've already touched on. That is, the resurrected Jesus doesn't belong in a graveyard any more than a newborn living baby belongs in a cemetery. But there is much more going on there, isn't there? What do I mean by more going on? What I mean is, let's ask a question. Where is Jesus now? Is he in the grave? He's not in the grave. We've just said it at the very beginning of the service. He's not. He's risen. Is he here at church bodily? Well, he's not, there's something I'm missing. He's not. He's alive. He's not dead. When you read on in Luke's next volume in the book of Acts, it speaks of Jesus ascending to be with his Father. Jesus is in the place of the living. Jesus will never die again. But where are we right now? It's a beautiful day here in Barara. We're not physically with Jesus. Physically, we are living, as wonderful as the weather is today, as wonderful as the place that we live in, as wonderful as the relationships that we share, we are living in a place of decay, of sadness, of frustration, of anger, grief, anxiety. We are living in the place of the temporary. So why did Jesus say that his death and his resurrection must happen? If Jesus is with his Father now and he said must happen, it almost looks from, if you look at it one angle, it looks like, why did Jesus waste his time? He came down and he's back up. What's changed? This is back to where it all started, right? Jesus said it must happen because in his resurrection he is building the future. He's showing how he is committed to recreating creation. The world we are living in now with its death and its decay is not the future. It's not the ultimate future. Jesus' kingdom is. He will return, yes, boldly and in glory. But in his resurrection, he's already given us like a teaser trailer of what is to come in his bodily resurrection. Jesus is described as the first fruits of things to come. He is writing and making the future for his people in that resurrection. He's shown the world a glimpse of just how wonderful and glorious it will be. It's interesting, in Oppenheimer, by the end of the film, he's become so convinced that his invention will change the course of history forever, but for the worst, beginning a chain reaction that will destroy the world. What about the resurrection of Jesus? It's the conviction of Christians for the last 2,000 years that there has been and will be no other event that will change the course of human history more than the resurrection of Jesus, and it will do it for the better, for the infinitely better. In the resurrection, God has started a chain reaction that will remake, renew, and rebuild his creation forever. If Christopher Nolan was making a movie, The Resurrection of Jesus, and I hope he doesn't, but if he was, he would probably add an incredible extended silence to the scene of the resurrection, wouldn't he? But of course, its significance wouldn't be able to be captured on any film. The resurrection is the moment where the course of history is changed forever. Well, what about you today? Where are you looking for life? Are you looking for the living among the dead? Or are you looking for life eternal in the person of the resurrected Jesus? The resurrection is not just an event of history. It is an event that has changed history and has changed the people of history forever. Well, I want to do something a little bit different this morning as we finish up to help us reflect on the significance of that. I'd like to invite Lissa up now to share a musical item with us, which is a little bit different, and you can join in if you feel so led. It's a tune that you might not know unless you've been on social media in the last few weeks. The song itself, I think, is a tiny example of the way in which the reality of the resurrection has changed and shaped human history profoundly. And the story behind this particular song is quite remarkable. It's called The First Hymn. And ironically, it was only released last week, but its roots go back nearly 1,800 years. In fact, its lyrics and even some of the music have only been recently discovered by historians and archaeologists. But they've uncovered this fragment of papyrus dated to the mid-200s AD, and on it were the lyrics of the earliest known Christian hymn. And even more profoundly, some of the musical notation, and the musicologists were able to reconstruct sort of the sounds and things like that. But we've got a new arrangement that's come out just recently, and it has a number of the fragments of the original tune and a lot of the words have been included. And I asked Lissa to sing this for us today just to help us reflect. And it's kind of bizarre to think about it because it really only came out about a week ago or so. So what Lissa's singing for us today is singing this song, one of the first times these lyrics have been heard in a church community for thousands of years, to remind us that the resurrection of Jesus is not just a modern idea. It's not just a crutch. It didn't just change a few lives. It's shaped history. We're not part of a passing trend or a modern invention. Christians have been singing this hope for centuries. Like those who have come before us, we are singing to the risen Son, to God our Father, to the Holy Spirit, rejoicing in the one who has changed the world forever. And the opening line of the song, I think, is quite fitting for this morning. It reminds me of that Oppenheimer scene, "Let all be silent."